Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to The Unknown Show, and I'm your host, Bud Smith. On today's show, we're going to talk to Nate Power about setting juggling records and his Cold Reads project. We're also going to talk to Meg Stewart about her novel, Domestic Apparition, that she's going to read for us. Later, Frankie Metro, a solo writer and puller from Albuquerque, New Mexico, will tell us about his project, including Cleft Jaw. I had this totally outrageous, mind-blowing dream that just completely messed my head over, because within it, I became privy to the deepest answers to existence, the kind of universal truths that empower human understanding, the kind of revelations that transcend the binding of time, that transcend the binding of life. I mean, sweet jumping Jesus, the kind of knowledge that transcends not merely the binding of life, but the meaning of life itself. Hell, it even transcended the bindings of self, and I woke feeling such a rush of adrenaline, such a burst of enlightenment, that I rushed right over here because I wanted to share it with you, because I knew you, of all people, would appreciate the significance of the imagery and the connection between the symbols and rituals I'd experienced. But in my hurry to share my enthusiasm with you, I forgot my pen, and I wasn't able to write it down. And I have totally forgotten what my fucking dream was about. Fuck me. That was a poem called, appropriately, Fuck Me, written by Paul Corman Roberts, the author of Neo Commuter, editor at Full Crow, master of ceremonies for the Beast Crawl Poetry Series in Oakland. Reach out to Paul for more info about that if you're in California or want to go to California and attend his event there. I was lucky enough to see Paul perform this poem in Albuquerque last year as a literary underground event called Mothpocalypse. It was a great time, and hoping to go to more of them soon. On today's show, we're going to do a few interviews. My first interview today is going to be Nate Power. I'd like to pull him on the air now. I see he's on the switchboard. Nate, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here, bud. How you doing?
Good, man. How you doing today? What's going on?
Oh, pretty good. Not too much going on.
Yeah, I want to introduce you. I want to tell everybody what your deal is. Nate is a writer, teacher, runner, coach, and juggler. He is the founding editor of the literary magazine Bartleby Snopes. His short fiction has been published in over 200 online and print journals. Count them, ladies and gentlemen. And he's been nominated for numerous awards. You have two books out, Nate, Reason to Kill and Hallways and Handguns. And it says here you've also set a world record by running a mile backwards while juggling in 8 minutes and 22 seconds. And that record has been confirmed. So, Nate, tell me about that, first off. Where did this juggling come from?
Well, first off, Bud, thanks for having me on the show. It's an honor to be here with you. Juggling... As far as that goes, there's not really any cool story for how it started, actually. My brother knew how to juggle. I went to a high school where pretty much everyone learns how to juggle, and he taught me before I went to high school, so I already knew how to do it when I got there. And it's just something that I kind of continued to practice after high school, you know, bust it out every once in a while to show off for people. And then as far as the juggling while running goes, I... actually was I coached high school track, and I was at a track meet at Kansas, over at the Kansas Relays.
Yes.
And I saw someone there who ran the 200 meters while juggling. And I thought, well, that's kind of cool. I can juggle, I can run. I'll combine these two things. And so I started doing that at track practice and trying to race kids while I was juggling and they were just running. And occasionally I would beat one of them. But mostly it was just a joke. I mean, it's not that serious of a thing, running while juggling. But the past couple of years I decided, you know, I'm not really that good of a runner.
Yeah.
Maybe if I start juggling while running, I can accomplish something. So I practiced a lot more. I would go on, you know, 10-mile runs out in the streets, out in the neighborhoods while juggling. And pretty soon I
got
pretty
good at being able to do it. You ran for
10 miles while juggling? 10 miles while juggling.
Holy fuck.
Well, there's people who've gone 6 hours in a row while juggling, while running. So 10 miles is nothing.
Really?
I just don't have 6 hours to go run around and juggle.
Well, yeah. Yeah, you're busy, right?
Yeah, I try to keep pretty busy.
Yeah.
Got a project or two in the works here.
Yeah, I bet. So you also you teach track, and you're a high school teacher in general. What do you teach in high school?
So I'm a high school English teacher. This year I'm lucky enough to have 4 sections of sophomore English 2, 1 AP language section, and 1 creative writing section, which, you know, for a writer you'd think, well, that's a dream come true, teaching creative writing. Not so much, bud. Not so much
it's
at all.
It's not? What's the reality of teaching creative writing?
Well, the reality, at least at the school where I am, is most of the kids don't like writing. They just took it because they needed an English credit, and a lot of them thought it was just going to be a blow-off class. Actually, a lot of them are surprised that they have to do a lot of writing during the class, which is always baffling to me, but they're not serious writers. They don't enjoy writing very much. It's sort of a frustrating experience.
Yeah. Do you have that, like, one kid or two kids in the class that are like the writers, or you don't have any of them?
Yeah, I do have
ones that really like it.
There's a couple of them who are really, really into writing,
and
hopefully the class will help them out to improve their craft a little bit. But there's a couple that do have a lot of promise that I've seen, so hopefully I'll be able to do something with them for them, and maybe for the kids who don't like writing, I can get them interested in writing.
Now, I don't want to mention the name of the school you teach at or even the town, but what state are you from? Were you
I'm in Missouri right now.
You're in Missouri, okay.
Yeah.
Now these kids that actually do like the writing, you know, they're like, let's say, any other writer I know, they're probably like looking to get published, and that starts young. Is it a secret from your kids that would actually care that you run a literary website, that you run Bartleby Snopes?
Well, actually, I haven't brought that up at all to any of the kids.
Yeah.
Sort of a fear, I guess, of having them submit their work. And I certainly want to encourage them to submit their workplaces, but I don't want that conflict of interest with them submitting work to me. I have had a couple of former students submit work to me. And I've had it where the student just didn't have anything that I was looking for, not that he wasn't a good writer, just his style of writing wasn't something that meshed with Bartleby Snopes. But just in general, I try not to talk about my writing. I do a little bit with the creative writing class just because I think that gets them more interested in writing. But in general, I don't like to talk about my writing with my students, especially given that some of the things that I write aren't really things that I need my students to read. A few years ago, we were in the computer lab, and some of my students, I guess, like Googling their teachers. And so they found out that I was a writer, and I'm walking around the computer lab making sure everyone's on task, and I see a kid at one of the computers, and he's reading one of my stories during my class. And it just so happens that the story that he was reading was called A Dick Move, and the first line of the story is, "Yesterday I was fired for fucking my boss's secretary." And I walked past him, and he looked at me and got kind of this embarrassed look at first, and then he said to me, you know, I don't really think this is an appropriate thing to write about. And I just looked at him and said, I think you need to close out of that right now and get back to work. And he asked if that was me, and I just told him it was somebody else with the same name because, you know, lots of people have the same name. He didn't buy it, and he continued to read my stories, but he didn't make a big deal of it. I think he became sort of a fan.
Well, that's cool. It's good to, it's good, you know, to keep a lot of writers, you know, have pen names. That's kind of cool that you don't, that you teach and you don't have a pen name and you go by your own stuff. But I guess it is difficult separating it from your teaching and keeping the kids separate from it. So back to Barnaby Snopes. What you said that you had gotten submissions, and let's just say that you mentioned that they're not what you were looking for particularly. Can you tell us what particularly you are looking for, Barnaby Snopes? What is its goal? What is it like?
Well, things have definitely changed. It's been going for 5 years now, and things have definitely changed in what we're looking for over the course of those years. But just in general, we're looking for really tightly crafted stories. We want every word to really count. We don't want a lot of excess. We don't want a lot of backstory. We're not big on expository styles of writing. We want to get right into the story and make it count and have that story develop naturally and organically rather than infusing it with all this backstory. We're not big on the tired plots that everybody's seen before. We really want something unique, unique voices, and we get plenty of excellent submissions. We really do, and we're grateful that there's a pretty big following of Barnaby Snopes out there.
Well, that's cool. You can't go wrong there. What are your other projects that you were mentioning besides your books that are out now?
Well, right now, the latest project that I launched is this Cold Reads project. I started this a couple weeks ago and got pretty instant positive feedback from it. But the basic premise is I will invite an author. Actually, I believe, Bud, that you were the first one that I read. So I invite an author onto to send me his or her wildest, craziest, funniest, most bizarre, twisted story, 1,500 words or less, something manageable that someone can sit down and listen to and just one sitting without investing too much time to it. And I won't read the submission ahead of time. When I'm ready to record, I'll sit down, I'll make sure all the audio equipment is working right, and then I'll press record, and I'll just read that thing straight through, first time read, first time I've looked at it, so I call it a cold read. And I think sort of the goal at first was, you know, just to see if I could do it, to see if I could keep my composure while reading it, because I noticed I was recording a story of mine called Cannibal Corey. I was recording it for the Surreal Grotesque, and there was this really dark comedic scene in there where a character is killed with an axe to the face. And it's something that as I'm reading it, even though I know it's coming, it sort of brings up this chuckle from within me. I know it sounds twisted. Why am I laughing at something like that? But just the way that it's presented, it's kind of a funny thing. You'll have to listen to the story to really get it. And then once I did that, I thought, well, this would be a lot of fun just to get these submissions that I've never read before and see if I can keep my composure when I'm reading them. I just did C.S. DeWilt's story last week, my friend Avery, and there's this line in there about how this guy's roommate is standing in front of him with his crooked spotted cock right in his face, and just reading things like that first time around, you know, sometimes it's just going to elicit this reaction, and I think people are kind of hoping that one day I'll just have this uproarious laughter during the middle of a story or something like that. I think it's become something where people want to hear my voice try to read their story. And so I'm looking forward to it. I've got about 12 episodes lined up right now. I've done four so far. Done you, I did Stephen V. Ramey, I did C.S. DeWilt, and I did Meg Tewitt not too long ago, and I hear she's on your show later tonight.
Yeah, she's on next. I hope she's up for coming on still. I hope she didn't decide not to now, you know.
Hopefully, yeah.
Yeah, hopefully she didn't say fuck it and she just went out bowling or something. I hope she's still on the line. We'll find out in a minute. So what's happening besides Cold Reach? Are you working on any manuscripts? You got any? I heard something about a collection of short stories. What's that?
Yeah, I've got
what's
a collection of stories that's coming out. Martian Lit's going to be releasing that one sometime this year. We don't have a firm date yet, but it should get out this year. It's called Nagging Wives, Foolish Husbands. Sort of this surreal collection of tales that involve husbands and wives interacting, but that's not really the big component of the story. It's more there's some crazy event that's going on. For example, there's a story in there called Happy Family where the wife gives birth to a boot, and the husband and wife have to deal with the fact that their child is a boot instead of an actual child. And then there's another one that was just published not too long ago on Old Timey Hedgehog called Pregnancy in the Wildebeest. Actually, it's renamed to Laundry Day. And the guy has a pregnant wife, and he's going to wash her underwear, and there's a wildebeest in the laundry room, and he's got to deal with that. And so it's got these little husband-wife interactions, and for the most part, the husbands are kind of these bumbling buffoons, and the wives are kind of these nagging, nasty people. Not always, though. There's some variation in that. And they just have to kind of deal with these crazy situations together.
Cool. I think usually you can write a naggy wife. You can write her as naggy and as shitty as you want, as long as you make the husband just as big a scumbag, if not worse, right?
Right. I think that's the key. Actually, this was a collection that another press had accepted. I'm not going to say who it was, but they had accepted it, and then after reading the collection for a second time, I guess, they decided they didn't want to publish it because they thought it would come across as misogynistic. So I think you're absolutely right. If you have these nagging wives, then the husbands have to be scumbags too. Otherwise, you're going to come across the wrong way. And the editor of that publication didn't say that she felt that way. She was afraid other people might feel that way. And I can understand that. If you don't feel comfortable, then you can't publish that. You got to publish what you feel comfortable publishing. And so just for the record, my wife is wonderful. She's not a nagging wife at all. And I really hope that I'm not a bumbling scumbag buffoon too.
Well, I bet you do. I bet you're okay. I bet you're fine.
Hopefully.
So I have a question too about podcasts. I know a lot of people, I started doing this, this radio show, for instance, it's not done as a podcast. It's just, this is on live. We're doing over the telephone right now. But people have been asking me a lot of questions about how do you make your own podcast. Well, guess what? I don't fucking know because I don't do podcasts. But now that I have you on the show, I'd like to know what do you do for your podcast for this Cold Reads? How is it done?
Well, I just got a new mic today, which I'm really excited about. It's actually a quality mic. I was using this piece of junk headset before, and I think everything was coming out kind of tinny and robotic, and I think it'll really improve here. But basically, I just record it, and then I upload it to a website called Podomatic.com, and they're really awesome. They create an RSS feed for you. RSS, I think I added an extra S there, but they create the RSS feed for you. They put it up on iTunes, and really all you have to do is upload a file, put a little description in, throw a picture up, and the rest is taken care of. They make it easy.
So anybody who wants to make their own podcast, they go to Podomatic. You can record on your computer using, if you have a Mac, something as simple as GarageBand. If you have a PC, I have no idea.
I've been recording with Audacity, which is a free program.
Okay.
And it's good. It's really good sound editing software.
That's awesome. So now run me through real quick what your actual setup is. I know you said you just got a new mic. Are you running, do you have like a USB mic? Are you running it into some kind of, a converter box to power into the computer? What's your setup right now?
So the new mic, it's a USB mic. It's kind of a higher end mic. It's supposedly one that the professionals use. And I've got a little pop filter to make sure we don't get too many of those popping sounds from the P's and the other letters that produce those pops. And I just run that through the computer. What's that?
Is it a Blueberry mic?
It is. It's a CAD mic.
A CAD mic, okay.
Yeah. It came highly recommended by... I asked a few people for the recommendations, a few musicians, and it was highly recommended, this particular mic. So hopefully it does a good job here.
Well, that's cool. So that's going good. The Cold Reef thing is going great. People can check that out. iTunes, search Cold Reef on iTunes, or just type...
You can get it from Podomatic, or you can get it from my blog, too.
Great. I want to thank you for coming on the show and talking about all your projects you have going on, some real interesting stuff. I hope you keep going with the juggling. I hope you continue to break your own records, because that's pretty cool shit.
Oh, well, thanks. I actually have this crazy idea. It's pretty nuts, but I want to try to run while juggling scissors.
Okay.
I mean, I've always heard you're not supposed to run with scissors. I guess you're probably not supposed to run while juggling. Why don't we put it all together and see what happens?
Sweet. Can you juggle scissors without moving right now? You can just juggle scissors, right?
I can juggle scissors without moving right now. I actually, juggling is something I do in the classroom sometimes. And the kids will just start saying, can you juggle that water bottle, that stapler, and those scissors? And I'll, sure. And I can juggle scissors pretty well. But once you get moving, I think things will change a little bit, probably become a little more difficult.
Well, that's great, man. Keep going with it. You know, I'm positive that you have videos of this stuff. Where can we see videos of you running, doing your juggling now?
Well, if you just go to my blog right now, there's a juggling link on there, and you can find that. And actually, last week you were talking to Robert Vaughn, and he was telling you about the basement apartment story. And so, and then you talked to Matt Garucki later and talked about how he was going to do videos on drunk monkeys. So I decided to do a basement apartment story, and I decided to record it as a video while juggling.
Really?
And I performed it in the basement, so I added that component to it as well, and I sent that over to Matt Garucki, and he's going to post that up on Drunk Monkeys in a couple weeks.
Look at that.
Yeah, I'm trying now to combine the writing and the juggling and see where that takes us, something new.
I wonder what else we can get people to do at home. What else can we get them to do? The limitations are endless, aren't they?
Suggest something and I'll give it a shot. I'll do anything.
Well, I'm not sure. We'll take some callers later. Maybe they can suggest some stuff for you to do after we get through our next couple of interviews here. Thanks again
like
for coming
plan.
On, man. It was great talking to you.
All right, thanks for having me, bud. It was great talking to you, too.
Yeah, we'll have to do it again sometime. I'll catch you later.
All right, sounds good. See ya.
Okay, I want to pull Meg Tewitt on the show right now. Meg is a writer who I admire a lot. She has appeared in 34th Parallel, Berkeley Fiction Review, JMWW, LMA, Drunk Monkeys, Book Review, Bartleby Snopes, which we just mentioned, Fool the Crow, and there's a list here that goes on for about 12 pages of all the places Meg's been published. I don't have time to read all of them. She's also the fiction editor of the Santa Fe Literary Review and Connotation Press, an online artifact. Mm-hmm. She has a monthly column, Exquisite Quartet, a Used Furniture Review. And she has a book out called Domestic Apparition from San Francisco Bay Press. Meg, are you there?
Hey, can you hear me?
How's it going? Yeah, I can hear you pretty good.
I was just on my way out to go bowling, and then I heard that, you know, the show was happening.
I was worried I wouldn't get you because I know you don't have a cell phone. You have like a pager, right? We got a pager and you call from like a payphone, right?
Well, you know, I don't have any phone, so yeah, I have to go out and run down the road, you know. And since I live kind of in the boonies of Santa Fe, I just kind of have to run out, hook myself up to like, you know how those guys have to go up onto the wires to get up there?
You're up
like,
on the telephone pole right now.
I know Nate is juggling and reading, but I'm actually up on top of a fucking tower reading, you know, talking to you, okay? So, Nate, I'm just saying to you, okay?
No, I already dropped him. I dropped him as quick as I could. He's off the air. So
well,
you have to
I hope
talk to him.
So I could add that to him. I mean, the backward running killed me. When I saw that I remember seeing that on Facebook, and I was like, my God, the guy's a maniac. And then the juggling and reading is killing me. I just absolutely love that. That's friggin' awesome. Anyway.
Yeah. I used to go into, like, record stores, you know, looking around for new music and stuff. And I thought I'd walk into the store, and I'd immediately forget the alphabet. So the fact that that dude, like, runs and reads and juggles and all that stuff, that's great.
It's amazing.
That's awesome.
Seriously. And then the cold read, I was hoping that you'd laugh at mine. I was really hoping. You know, like everyone hopes. You're always hoping, like I'm sure you were with yours. I was waiting for him to break down, but he never did. He's got that, like, real calm kind of thing happening. It goes all the way through. And I'm like, he did it. He made it all the way through. I'm amazed. So, anyway.
If I had to deal with high school kids every day, I'd be cold as ice, too. I'd be like a trained killer, you know?
Yeah, you're right. He's probably seen and heard it all. So, like, for us, it really doesn't even matter. You know what I mean? No matter what we write, it's not even going to come close to what these people have to say, I'm sure, these students. I couldn't do high school students. There's no way in hell.
I like how you said students with, like, utter disdain. Students.
No, no, no. I'm a teacher. I would never say that. I work with, like, most of my students are older than me, and, you know, I teach at Santa Fe Community College, and I do, I teach flash fiction. So I love.
No shit.
But I'm with students that, like, we have a good time. We really enjoy it. And there are students that are doing continuing education. So, therefore, there are people that work all day, and then we have a night class, and it's always great. Yeah. No. I love students. I do.
Wow, that's pretty wild. That's pretty wild that you teach right there in the Santa Fe Community College flash fiction. That's awesome. How long have you been doing that?
I've only taught, let's see, 3 or 4 semesters now, and I'm going to start teaching again when I get back from AWP. My class will start. And it's a pretty intensive class, which is half of it is sort of working on the structure of flash fiction. My last class, you know, we're very near Los Alamos, where all the, you know, serious, like, physicists and whatever are, you know, there, and they've never written fiction. And my last class were all scientists. I thought I'd die. Like, oh, my God, what am I going to do with this? But they were amazing. I mean, we just went with sci-fi, and they did really well. And half of the class I've got set up structured, working on, you know, how to, because they don't even know what flash fiction is. You know, a lot of people don't know that it's just working, you know, really condensed pieces. And then the last 3 weeks are all about publishing, and I get them to send out to 5 different places, and I'll pick the magazines for them after reading and editing. And I have them, you know, go into small groups, they edit each other's work, I edit their work, and then all of us come together at the end, and then I give them each 5 places to send to, and most of them, you know, I've got to say I've gotten, I don't know, maybe 10 of them have been published so far, and yeah, it's amazing, actually.
That's pretty cool. That goes a lot for somebody. Just walking them through, like, what, like, first of all, what's involved, and once you have an idea how to write it out, you know, maybe you don't so much teach that, because that's natural, right? Someone's writing is natural, but how many people have, like, really sat down, once they've written something, do you start out with them having a word limit, or you just tell them, write a story, and then you're like, surprise, you got to edit your 1,000-word story down to 200 words?
Well, no,
is that how you do it?
No, I have to give them, you know, a whole the whole setup, so they know what's ahead each time. But it's very, very condensed, and they have a lot of work when they're in it. And it's only 6 weeks and 2-hour classes, so each time we get together, there's a lot that has to happen. And so they can't really even miss a class because, you know, there's so much. And they have to, the first story they bring, they have to edit it through twice through their groups. And, you know, so they can't, either bring it in, they read it to each other, they do this little edit between 4. I always put them in groups of 4. So and then they take it home, they work on it. I also edit their work. Then they get that. They also bring it back in. They have to, you know, I teach them also the protocol of, like, how to be, you know, sort of positive about each other's work, at least to start out that way. with what you find that works in a story, and then you go into the parts that don't work and what you're confused by. And, you know, and I'm also reading them a lot of, which is really fun. I'm reading them a lot of, you know, writers that are out there, friends of mine. And so I get to read whatever comes up. So I'm always looking at different magazines, you know, and bringing in new stuff. And, you know, we start out the class with reading, and then we always end up with doing an exercise. So they always have an exercise they have to do each time as well, a prompt. So it's, you know, it's really fun, actually.
Yeah, it sounds like a fucking party. Honestly. Maybe, I don't know,
and
maybe that's just me, because that's something, that's a class I would like to take.
Yeah, and I
gotta say,
the class. I don't have like high school students where you're supposed to be like, you know, all dressed up and shit. I can go in and like swear and stuff, and they laugh. They love it. I mean, even though some of them are 80 years old, Jesus Christ. But I love that they're doing it, and they love it, and they get really excited. And every time they get published, they send it to me on my email and let me know they have another one published. I had one girl who's gotten 4 published now, and I get them to think about working on blogs. I tell them about Duotrope. You know, we get into all different kinds of things. And so it's really, it's fun. Yeah, it's fun teaching.
I think that flash fiction, which generally is people who are listening at home, you still don't really understand what we mean by flash fiction. It's like a piece of fiction that's generally under 1,000 words, but most of the time, typically, it's under 500, if not even briefer than that. You'll get 250 words, 200 words, some places 50 words. The famous flash fiction one is Hemingway's 6-word story, right?
And I bring that up, and we do micro flash. I have them whittle down and whittle down and whittle down, and some of them come in and they say, "Hell no, I'm writing a historical novel. You know, there's no way in hell I can do this." You know, and they end up loving it in the end, you know, because it's a great way to really, really hone in on what it is you're trying to say. Your theme has to be, you know, key. And, you know, what I say is, you know, there's that plot that moves, you know, you've got what is supposedly the old pyramid, which is the exposition, then it moves into the rising action, then it moves into the climax, then it moves into, you know, the declining, and then it moves into the ending, which is supposedly the surprise ending. And I say pretty much with flash, you've got to start past the exposition. You get right into the rising action, or you start at the very top right before the climax. And I have them do exercises where they start, like, let's say 5 minutes before whatever it is happens that they want to write about, and then they go like 5 minutes after, maybe, or they just go and they stop. You know, I said there is no resolution. There's a lot of white space that you have to work with, and you have to trust
it's
your readers.
It's what you don't say.
Yeah, and I think they learn that they have to trust the readers as well. And I say, remember how you read things. And when you read it through, if it makes sense to you and it's something that you find interesting, I said, if you don't find it interesting yourself, forget it. Nobody else is, okay? So you've got to love what you're reading. You've got to find it exciting, and then you've got to send it, you know. Then you think about sending it out there and see what happens. And then we talk a lot about rejections, because we know in this field, you know, that's part of
it. You get a lot of rejections, you know.
So I say, if you're not ready to get that rejection, then don't send it out. If it's too personal to you, it's not ready. It's not something to be sent out, you know. You have to be ready to accept whatever's going to come your way. So.
Yeah. Yeah, you know? you get a lot of rejections, you know.
That's right.
So,
I could wallpaper your rooms with that, with all those with all those beautiful rejections.
Yeah, what's the favorite place you ever got rejected from? Off the top of your head, can you remember any?
Are you friggin' kidding? Hell yes, I can remember those. We always remember the ones we don't get accepted to. It's the ones we get accepted to we might forget, but the ones we don't,
How about when you get done writing something and you're like, holy fuck, this is the best story I ever wrote, right? And you send it out, it gets rejected by everybody. But then, you know, you can't get that one published anywhere. But if something's like, you're like, yeah, this is okay, it gets picked up like immediately, and you're like, what the fuck just happened?
I know. I mean, I've had some. I had one that I sent out to a ton of places, and it was one of my longer pieces, and I had sent it out, and it, you know, it was one of those where I sent to like Agni and different places where it takes a longer period of time.
Uh-huh.
You know, sometimes a year, you know, you wait. And
yeah.
I got a lot of rejections that came through with that. Some people lost it. I don't know what the hell happens when you get lost in their fields. But then it got picked up by a really good magazine, and then it won awards and stuff. So, you know, I...
What was that story?
It was called Garbage Picker of Memory, which is in my collection, my novel and stories. I don't know if you remember that one. It's the one writing the letter. Yeah. And,
that was in Domestic Apparition.
Mm-hmm. So Berkeley's... No. It was Valparaiso Fiction Review picked it up, and then they sent it in for a nomination for the Pushcart. And it was Editor's Choice or something, you know. So,
yeah.
I mean, you never know. You never know
how
it's going to go. And it's like we say, I'm an editor, so I know how subjective it is, you know.
Yeah.
And
so for people listening at home who don't know about Pushcart, what they do is you get nominated by a magazine or a website for a Pushcart, what actually happens is the Pushcart people send you a box with 100 doves in it, and you get to just have the doves. You can put them in your house, and they fly around. They follow you everywhere. It's pretty awesome. And then you get to put it in your bio, too, that you're nominated or if you win.
Don't forget the case of wine. You know, I mean, every month they send you something. They're so nice. They're such nice people.
Just for being nominated.
You never know what's happening every time you get something. I was
like,
going to tell you were saying that. I'm like, basically nothing happens, okay? You get nominated.
Yeah.
And then you never hear again from anybody. It's just, you know, it's a nice thing to be nominated, just whatever. But, you know, it sort of like flies off, and like you say, the doves, they fly off, and God knows you never see them again. Or they might be pigeons. I'm not quite sure. Anyway.
Yeah. Tell me more about Domestic Apparition. We were just touching on that. I actually just read it. I'm in the process of reviewing it. I won't tell you too much of my review. You'll get to read my review.
I'm reading your collection right now or something like that. I was telling you how much I love some of the stories. I haven't gotten through it. I've been reading. I have so many things going right now, but I'm reading at night and really enjoying it. Really think it's great.
Well, that's why I liked your book, because it's broken up. Your book, Domestic Apparition, is a novel. It's a
mm-hmm.
novel told in a thread of short stories, which is perfect because mm-hmm. I am the fucking worst reader these days. I don't read anything. I just got another book in the mail that I'm probably not going to read that for another year and a half either, just because, you know, you get all these projects, they just keep snowballing and everything, blah, blah, blah. So
tell me
about Domestic Apparition. What is it to you? What was it to write?
It was a long process, but it was a really fun process for me. It was... you know, it started out where I was publishing stories in the Lit Mag, and I was getting, you know, a lot of them published. And then when I decided that I had a collection, I made it into sort of what you call a novel and stories with the same narrator and the same family. And then once I felt like it was ready, but I'd say 10 to 15 years of work on that. And I'm not saying that it takes 10 to 15 years to work on a collection by any means, but I spent a lot of time on that one, and anyway, I sent that out, and I got a couple publishers that were interested, and then you make that decision, and I went with a smaller publisher, the San Francisco Bay Press, who mostly published poetry, but they
mm-hmm.
wanted to, like, they only published a few fiction books before mine, but they only published, like, 6 books a year, and I liked that, camaraderie and the closeness when you work with a publisher who calls you and you deal with, and you're able to like say yes or no on a cover, and you know, you have a lot of input in it. It was really really a nice experience for me. So
it's almost working with such a small house, it's almost like you have this unlimited freedom with your personal choices if you're going to, let's say, self-publish. But then you also you don't have those people that are a team behind you, let's say, really helping you with the editing and helping you with all the other stuff. So that's the decision you make going for a smaller place, huh? That's cool.
I enjoyed it. I really did, you know, and they did a great job with it. I love the cover, and, you know, I've gotten such great feedback. I mean, that was published in 2011, so we're talking, you know, a year and a half ago or something, and I don't know. I feel really good about it, and it was a great first collection for me, and I had a really positive experience with it, so I'm really happy. And now I have quite a few projects in the wings, boy, I can tell you. I'm juggling, but I'm not reading at the same time, okay?
Yeah.
I'm juggling with writing, let's say, okay?
Yeah. So, I was wondering, do you have anything you could read for us as an example of what you've been working on, what's something you'd like to share? Do you have anything you could read?
Yeah, I have a couple of flash pieces. I have the one from my exquisite duet that, you know, Robert Vaughn read
yeah.
his piece, and he and I were together in the first January, you know, issue for that. That's my column up at Used Furniture Review, and it's really, really fun because I pick two people each month, and I give them a first sentence. And they both get the same first sentence. They don't know what each other is writing. And it's supposed to be, you know, sort of poetic prose and poetry. I'm sort of, you know, focused on that right now. And 250 words tops. So that's what I give them. And I'm booked through April with an amazing cast of people. It's amazing. So I was going to read that piece. See if you want me to.
Yeah, please. That's great. I loved Robert's piece last week. He was great to have on because he's a funny motherfucker, you know.
Yes, he is. I love Robert, and I, you know, I'm really looking forward to meeting you at AWP, where I know we're gonna have a good time. So this one is called Junk Bond. I moved into a basement apartment, found myself entrenched in shadows that daylight couldn't thwart. Dark angles made denser by Borya, a rabbit bull of a Russian I unearthed from a vagrant bar one night. We staggered in every afternoon with gifts, dragging massive boxes of cardboard, planks of wood, half-eaten couches and chairs, saying, "What the hell? America's massive dump? What thief of economy throws grand circumstance away?" The Russian and I went at each other's junk like the packs of cigarettes we sucked on before and after we became a human landfill of overripe histories and orgasms. I waited until he left each morning for more of his so-called gems and then heaved out a few at a time so he wouldn't notice, trashed them in the alley. In and out, our lives pulsed like lungs without the pink, without ending pantomimes of despairing couples buying new stuff to keep from sex and dying. Borya was going to construct an us out of damaged goods. I limped out to the dumpster with a battered table. "You," Borya said, stepping out of shadows, clutching a broken lamp. I dropped the mutilated table. Who else, I thought. Secondhand man was somewhat demented, but the sex was torrid. Bulldoze savages, hostage to shiny plastic from Walmart, he sighed. Bit a cigarette between his lips, picked up the table and lamp. "Come," he said. "I must bankrupt these streets of childhood from you." I could be recycled. I raised an eyebrow, nodded. That's Junk Bond. Did you like my Russian accent?
Yeah, you sounded great. Did you ever think about doing like a whole semester of your college class pretending you were like Russian or something?
I spent my whole childhood doing shit like that. We used to cruise Chicago. I grew up in Chicago, and we would cruise around and pretend we were blind, or we would pretend we spoke French, or we would pretend we were Russians. We used to go out on the L, and, like, you know, like my friend would pretend she was blind, and I'd pretend I was some immigrant, and we totally had a blast. We did it all the time. I spent my whole childhood either Southern or wherever, and we'd act like we didn't know where we were going, and we were just little vagrant psychos that totally had a good time.
Where was you? Chicago?
Yeah, I grew up in Chicago.
You grew up there in Chicago, and now you live down in the Southwest.
Now I'm in the desert.
What's what's the biggest difference you think between the two?
Oh Jesus, everything and everything. Let's see.
Right?
Yeah, I grew up in Rogers Park, which is like in Chicago. It was like a working class neighborhood, but it was a lot of Catholic families, so there were like tons of kids everywhere, and we were all creating havoc wherever we could. Like we used to, I was with a bunch of hoodlum girls. We jumped roofs and like. We were maniacs, you know, and we would get on the L and go anywhere. Our parents didn't give a shit what we did as long as we were home by 6 and sitting at the table, you know, at like that time. They didn't care. They didn't even want to hear what we did that day in the summers, you know.
Yeah.
That was a good time, you know. Now parents have to really watch over their kids. And when I grew up, nobody gave a shit, you know. They were just like, just get back by 6. So we had a good time. But now I'm living in Santa Fe, sort of. Not Santa Fe proper, but on the outskirts a little bit. So we have 12 acres. My husband, Paolo, and I, he's from Italy, believe it or not, and he's now living in the boonies. But
tricked him, huh?
What's that?
You said you tricked him, huh?
Well, no, he'd been here for like 25 years. He was here a long time. Like, he's been here in the Southwest, Denver, Colorado for a while. He's moved around a bit, you know. That was before we got married. He was moving around. But, yeah, he's been here for quite a while. He's a psychologist, and he has worked all over the place and whatever. So he loves it here, too. But, you know, I'm really happy, and he is, too. He's from Milano, which is a very big city, and it's nice not to be right in the city. And this city is such a joke compared to what we grew up. I mean, you know, it's like 60,000 to 70,000 people. So I don't know what you call it. But anyway, so we have like 12 acres out here with our rescue animals. So it's kind of on the outskirts. So I got my little dirt bike. I get to go roaming around, and I really suck at it.
You sound like a real badass. You're like,
no,
dirt biking and shit?
I totally pretend to be a badass, but I'm really not. I really suck. Every time I take a turn, I hit the gas instead of. All I do is laugh through the whole thing. I've hit the dirt so many times you can't even imagine.
Yeah.
I can't even believe the thing still works. You know what I'm saying? But he grew up with motorcycles, so he drives a motorcycle every day to work, and like he's got a bunch of different dirt bikes and stuff, and my sister dirt bikes, and you know, so that's how I kind of got into it, and it's fun out here because you have a lot of back roads and dirt roads. And even if you're an asshole like me and you're throwing yourself around, like there's no traffic, like no one's going to run into you. You know what I'm saying? maybe a rabbit, cause I live on Crazy Rabbit Road. Okay.
Yeah.
So maybe a rabbit's going to run into me, but that's it. So it's fun.
Well, that's interesting as hell to me. And I want to thank you for coming on. It's great that you know, you actually live pretty close to my next guest who's going to come on, Frankie Metro. He's living in Albuquerque.
Really?
So,
you said that you guys were, like, hanging out together in out there. That's awesome.
Oh, yeah. I'm going to send him on a bus up to you. You guys are going to ride dirt bikes and jump crazy rabbits and all kinds of fucked up stuff.
Totally would love to.
Really, though.
Let him know.
Thanks for coming on, man. We you know, I could have talked to you for another hour here, and I'm sorry that Nate got cut off so quick. I wish the show was 5 hours long, but thanks for coming on. I want to bring the next guest on, Frankie
well,
Metro.
Thank you, so much,
is,
bud. Thank you, bud.
Oh yeah, thanks for coming on.
I just wanted to say thank you. It was really.
So Frankie Metro is a close friend of mine and my go-to writing partner online. He's a top-notch editor, knows his shit about music. Currently, he writes articles and reviews for Unlikely Stories and his local Albuquerque paper, The Alibi. He runs Cleft Jaw, a new literary journal with Dustin Holland. And Frankie is also the author of the poetry collection, The Anarchist Black Book of Poetry. Frankie, are you there?
I am here. I did want to make like one quick correction. I am not writing for The Alibi. I would love to, but currently, like currently, just not, unfortunately. So maybe that'll work out. I don't know.
Oh yeah. Well, see, dude, I got all my facts all fucked up. You should see
Rest of it was on point. You giving me something to aspire to anyway. So don't even sweat it, for real.
cool, man. Yeah. Well, so listen, tell me about Albuquerque. We were just talking to Meg Tewitt about living in Santa Fe, and you're not too far down the road. What's going on in Albuquerque these days?
You got to be hard to make it here, man. You know, you got your real cool mix of, like, chill people that are really into the art scene, and then you've got your straight burqueños, which, you know, like, out here, fuckers, like, drink hairspray to get high, and, like, knife fights, the whole nine, man. It, like, really toughens your skin a little bit, and I think that's, like, right now it's cold as shit, so, you know, it really just makes you tough. The wind makes you tough. You know, I mean, it just, it's all part of it, man, and it's home, actually. I mean, it really is. It feels like home, and I haven't been able to say that for, shit, man, for a long time. This is home.
Yeah. I got to hang out with you there recently for some events, that poetry events that happened, and it was real cool, man. You took me around, showed me around town, took me and my wife around. It was cool. Cool seeing some of the places, drinking spots. What was that drinking spot we went to?
Chama River. Chama River. Yeah.
Chama
that's
River.
That's my...
some great beer.
No, that's my cheers spot, man. That's where, you know, walk in,
they
everybody knows
name,
your
you
name.
They walk in, they go, thank you, Metro!
Well,
awesome,
they call me by my Christian name there, unfortunately, but, you know.
Yeah, that's cool. Yeah, that works. That doesn't matter, man.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, that was a fun time. I remember we were drinking with Ryder Collins, and we were drinking with Andrew Bogling, who goes by, what the fuck is his?
William Stewart Bonney? Yeah.
Doc Bonney, yeah. He's and you're actually, you're doing Clefjaw, which is, I was just talking about, it's a literary website, literary rag, you're putting out with Dustin, right? Dustin Holland?
That's correct, yes.
And you guys are going to be putting out a book of poetry with our little drinking buddy there, Mr. Andrew, right? What's going on with that?
Oh, man. Galaxy versus Sabretooth is the name of it. That'll be coming out on 4/20, 2013.
Yeah.
Man, it's going to be 40 pages, perfect bound, glossy cover, 6x9, whole nine. I don't know, I told you a little bit about it, but, like, I mean, the kid, he writes enjoyable love poems, and that's something that, you know, is totally missing out of the literary scene, I think. I mean, it's really hard to make a love poem good, except for the person that you're writing it to or about, and this kid has got a real knack for it. Yeah.
Without making it sappy, without making it overly saccharine, right?
Right, exactly. I mean, you don't want to... I'm glad you said saccharine, because, I mean, it honestly makes me think of, like, the difference between... I don't know. It makes me think of the difference between actual sugar and sweetener. Mm-hmm. I can't stand
there
sweetener, bro. Yeah.
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 Yeah, when it's done right, it can't be beat, though.
Exactly. Yeah. And
so
he does.
Cool,
I mean,
man.
It's not just love poems. I mean, he's got a lot of great stuff in there. It's, you know, a lot of introspective shit, man. And I'm kind of jealous of this kid because he's only 23 and, like, he's already got, like, a really tight handle on who he is as a writer, and that's the way it's supposed to be.
Yeah. Well, I would say that if you think it's taking you a little too long, I say maybe that's what you think, but everybody's different, and I'm a big fan of the stuff that you've put out. I've read a lot of your writing that's not released yet, you know, because online, I love you're my go-to guy, man, my writing partner. So I see a lot of stuff the world hasn't seen yet, and I dig it, man. I dig the stuff you've been doing.
Oh, I appreciate that, sir. And same goes for you. I mean, to be honest with you, you're talking about Andrew, you're talking about Dustin. I mean, like, the three of you guys right now have inspired the fuck out of me just recently, and I mean, it's really just put me into this whole new, like, realm of, like, where I feel empowered as a poet, which is something that I've always been, like, it's always been a kind of a flash in the pan thing for me, poetry. I mean, I'm a prose writer by heart, and, you know, you guys have really sparked the, like I said, man, I mean, you've really sparked this sort of love for poetry that I have now. I don't know.
Yeah, I used to feel very similar about poetry, too, you know, just something... something I did that kind of didn't really feel too much, but it comes and goes, you know. But definitely lately, one of the reasons I dragged you on the show was to talk about your book of poems that came out last year from Crisis Chronicles. Your book is called The Anarchist Black Book of Poetry. Would you talk a little bit about that book?
Oh, man. It's so hard for me to talk about that book now.
I bet it is, yeah.
It really is, man. I mean, it was, like, super personal for me. Let me just go ahead and set it up for you. It's 2010. You know, I'm living in Clearwater, Florida, and I'm dating a writer, and she's, you know, just gotten out of this, like, tumultuous marriage that she's in and whatnot. And, you know, like, a lot of times, I ended up there basically because I was, like, I don't know, ostracized from, like, the community that I grew up in. In a sense, I mean, like, I had problems with my baby mama and all this other bullshit, so I skipped town. And I went out to Clearwater, Florida, with my heart in one place and, you know, my mind in another. And that book is what came about because, I mean, it's about the – I want to make a specific point about the title. The title is The Anarchist, as in a singular anarchist. Not anarchists, like a plural. No, I was just saying, like, that's part of the whole theme of the book is I wanted it to be about being, as I told you a little bit about, it's about being an individual and fearing individualism or being trapped by it or loathing it or being completely empowered by it. It's an exploration of, God, man, I don't even know how to explain it. Like, I was reading a lot of Henry Miller at the time, and I was going through a lot of bullshit. And that book is what came out of it. I literally, like, one day I was working for this survey company in Largo, Florida, which is, like, really close by. And basically what we do is get people to call in and try to, you know, sell them, like, insurance plans or whatever. And, you know, I had a tendency to take longer breaks and to take more frequent breaks sometimes. You know, it's just the normal thing to do there. Everybody did it. Yeah. And one day I'm sitting, like, across from a duck pond. It's, like, I don't know, like, it's my first break out of, like, 10 that day.
Yeah.
And I just started writing this poem in a little bitty notebook, and it just kept going and going and going and going. And I had never, like, had one go, like, 30 pages before, you know what I mean? Like, I just didn't understand that. And I sit there and I'm, like, reading through it, and it was, like, literally, like, a chronicle of where I'd come from to where I was sitting at that duck pond. And then later on, after I left Clearwater, it became a chronicle of, like, leaving Clearwater and going to Phoenix and then going to Albuquerque and then, you know, ending up finding the love that I was searching for, which I don't even know if the book really touches on that, to be honest with you. And that's why it's so hard for me to talk about, is because I'm just completely not even in that, like, headspace anymore. And that's,
well,
I mean, like, you've been like that before, right? Like, you look back on something that you wrote, like, 3 years ago, and you're like, God damn, like,
Let me tell you something. I wrote a book, a novel in 2005, and it was about a guy who hates his marriage, hates his wife, and just is miserable, is a miserable motherfucker. And recently it's going to be published, so I'm working with guys on that book, and I'm just all the time looking back on them, doing rewrites on it, and I'm just like, how the fuck did I write this? Because it's just not who I am. You know, so I totally sympathize with what you're saying. But I guess at the same time, it's like really cool, you know, it's really cool that you can look back at something and say, okay, so I've changed a lot since I wrote that. You're not just
capping,
right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, in all honesty, back then it was a lot of, like, I believe John Swain, he wrote one of the first reviews about it, and he used a term there. He said, like, trenchant observation. And, like, I think that was, like, really appropriate for that book, is if I felt like I was watching everything from the gutter, or I was watching everything from, like, the trenches of some, like, I don't know, a magnanimous imaginary war that I had built for myself. And, you know, that's kind of where it led me, was, like, at the end of the book is the end of that long epic poem that started at the duck pond. And the funny thing is, like, I ended up talking to my wife, like, one of the first times I talked to my wife, she was sitting at the Duck Pond here in Albuquerque, New Mexico, at the University of New Mexico. And it kind of, it kind of felt like it was just ironic in a sense, you know.
Yeah, it definitely is. It definitely is like an ironic thing, you know, to talk to somebody new that you're happy with about something that was a painful thing you don't want to look back on anymore, right?
Yeah, I mean, and I'm not going to sit there and say that, like, the woman that I was with beforehand, like, we didn't have our good times, because we did, you know, and, you know, we learned from each other, and we took, you know, what we learned, and we moved on, and she's doing really great now, from what I can tell, and more power to her and stuff like that. It's awesome. And
cool. That's
what I really wanted to take from it, was just reconciliation from that book. I didn't, I didn't take any money for it. I just gave it out for free whenever, like, I got copies. But, you know, like, it wasn't even about the money for me. It was about having something out there, like a tombstone to my old self, I guess.
Yeah, I bet. I mean, it's really cool. It's really cool to put a book out, regardless of what you get paid. Everybody, I know a lot of people who really want to do it. They just don't do it because, first of all, they don't write it to begin with, and then they get hung up on the idea of they don't want to get ripped off, or they're waiting for the perfect opportunity. But, hey, if you're going to be a writer, write. Put your shit out. Get your stuff out. Have people read it. All that stuff. However you got to get it done. You're not going to live forever.
Yeah.
You know?
Exactly. It did what it did. I was just saying, it did what it did. So, yeah.
Cool. What's the deal in Albuquerque, man? When I was out there, you didn't have a car and you were skateboarding around everywhere.
Well, I gotta be honest with you, man. I gotta buy some new Vans before I can do any skating. Like, my heel is just completely busted out. So. I love skateboarding, bro. Like, I remember being like 8, 7 years old, and I had like one of the really small, like, I don't know, like maybe like 2 foot long, fucking like little yellow banana boards, like really skinny boards. I'm sure you've seen them.
Yeah.
But like, I used to have one of those, and like my neighbors had this huge driveway, and it was like at the top of the hill. You had everything. It had like a little dip. It was like just like a bowling lane, basically. And what we would do is we would like stack up like little trash cans at the bottom of the hill, me and my little brother. And like, this is when the neighbors would let us come over. And my neighbor would be riding like a tricycle or a fucking bike or like a big wheel or something. And like, me and my brother would be riding like our, you know, respected skateboards. And we would just like take off like bullets at the top of the hill and just try to slam into these trash cans as hard as we could. And it, like, just from there, like, it literally bred this whole love for skateboarding, because I think that that's what skateboarding is, like, I literally sometimes I'll fucking try to do like a power slide, and like, I'll just kick the board out from under me at the end of it, and I'll kick it at somebody or like at some building or something. Like, it's about, skateboarding is about, you know, skate or die attitude. And, you know, I mean, you got a lot of guys out here that are really good at making tricks and shit like that, and that's cool. Like, but the school that I'm from, like, we just like to tear shit up. And I mean, that's what skateboarding's always been for me. It's always just been like a real good release for, like, you know, aggression or whatever.
That's badass, man. It's bad. I can barely walk, you know. I fall down just walking, so I'm really impressed by Nate with his juggling and his running, and Meg too with climbing those utility poles to make your phone calls, and you with your skateboarding. You guys are inspiring with that crap. It's awesome.
Oh, thanks, man. Actually, like, Lindsay tells me all the time, like, I need to be skating more, and she keeps telling me, she's like, you're really fluid on there. And I'm like, that's totally the opposite of, like, what I'm going for. Like, I'm not trying to be, like, a surfer. Acrobatic. Yeah, I just want to be hardcore and, you know.
Yeah.
But I'm not that hardcore kid anymore. Like, I'm fucking 30 years old, and, like, my bones creak a little bit more now. So, yeah.
True that, man. Hey, listen, I don't want to waste this opportunity. Can I get you to read something?
Yeah, sure. This one's a, you know, I'm actually about to come up on my 2-year anniversary with Lindsay in a couple of days, actually. And,
congratulations.
Oh, thank you, man. I appreciate it.
Yeah, she's awesome, man.
She's been a real fucking, like, light and a save, or saving grace, man. And I wrote, like, love poems. I write love poems to her a lot. Like, I really do. I like to. But this is not a love poem to Lindsay. And it doesn't have anything to really do with Lindsay. It's just, I don't know. It sprung from a conversation that we had about something. I can't even remember. But the name of it is Prenup. The shattered, unspoken mouth of hell is asking for a divorce from the cruel, unflinching nerve of the egoist bedside manner. Matter of fact, it's been given on good authority that once the theatrics are all but played out, every demon in the Legion of the Larynx will come out with a gold or platinum tooth that whistles like a catastrophe near a schoolyard crossing. If there's any chance for reconciliation, it lies in being able to recognize how much fun is too much fun, and we all know that the ego is abrupt, forceful. We know it as cunning and at the same time oblivious to other pleas for rationality. But it's a kinky game it plays with itself, where instead of platinum-plated underlings with the capacity for independent vertical mobility, the egoist sees progressive opportunity. Each tiff with the undoing is like a phrenology course you mistake for church. Every move in the heart of a beast is effort toward strangling something or the soft, everlasting touch. There's no real difference in species, the nuptial between hell and the ego. It's as sacred as the hand-broker deal between piety and success. There's just more red in the color scheme. And that's it.
That's cool as hell, man.
Oh, thank you.
That's pretty deep stuff considering you know, just there's a lot going on in that poem, man. I've read that online quite a few times. That's a good one.
Oh, thanks, man. I don't even sometimes some of these poems, man, I'll write them and it'll take me like a good 2 years to really figure out what the fuck I was talking about.
Yeah.
But it comes from somewhere. And, you know, it comes from somewhere, I think, that's, like, a little bit ahead of myself. Or at least I hope that it is.
Sure. Yeah, like, looking back on it later, you can... It's kind of like a stamp from where you were, and you can't see it until you're out of it, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, I want to thank you, man. I want to thank you a lot for coming on. And thanks a lot for coming on and reading that really sick poem right there. And tell us about Albuquerque and your different projects that you have going on, Cleft Jaw. It was a real, real pleasure having you come on the show, and I hope the show keeps going. But most importantly, I hope that if it does, that you're able to come on and read some stuff periodically and update us what you're doing these days. All right?
Yeah, sure. You never know. Like, I might be around.
Right on, man. So thanks for coming on, man. I'm gonna let you go right now. And I want to thank Meg Tewitt for coming on the show, for reading. I want to thank Nate Tower for coming on and telling us about his juggling and his great site, Barnaby Snopes, and telling us about teaching in Missouri. It was great. And also I want to thank Paul Corbin Roberts for letting me read his excellent poem, Fuck Me, in the beginning of the show. I really dig that poem, and it means a lot to me to hear that in Albuquerque. If you get a chance, go see Paul perform. If he has any events coming up, you can find out through his Facebook. Is usually where he keeps updated. He's an excellent performer, and check him out if he's performing anywhere near you, usually in the Bay Area. Thanks for listening to the show. That's going to be it for today, and hope to see you next Tuesday. Thanks for listening.